Welcome to Oil and Whiskey, an Ironclad original. I am Josh Henning.
I'm Phil Gerber.
I'm Jeremy Gerber.
Welcome to Oil and Whiskey, an Ironclad original. Today, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations from season two. Stick around to hear highlights from our time with Joe Rogan, Sean Davis, Lance Stander, and many more. Back in March, Justin Olson of Dakota Digital came on the show, just after their new products achieved significant recognition, securing first place in Power Sports, runner-up in Street Rod, Custom Car and Interior, and three Global Media Awards at SEMA.
Was Justin wearing cargo pants when he was sitting there?
Probably. I think cargo shorts.
You couldn't see because of where the table cuts you off. But the cop thing, I don't remember.
I think it was cargo shorts and Tevas.
Okay.
We'll have to go back to the tape.
Now that you mentioned that, you may be right. That it's coming back to me.
Yeah. Listeners, let us know. Yeah.
He was wearing a baseball jersey, too, I think.
Is there a part of a team?
Shots fired.
That part should probably be edited out.
I loved how you did the cock. And it wasn't just a shoot. You had to cock it every time.
It's a single shot.
Yeah. Here's a clip of the interview. To change it up just a little bit, since you've listened, I don't want all prepared questions, prepared answers.
Oh, I am prepared so, for squat.
Best cop story. I like the hide and go seek. Hide and go seek was pretty good, but best cop
story. That one I wasn't prepared for.
Craziest, yeah. Wildest, it doesn't matter. I mean,
there's a lot of fun pursuits and a lot of fun chases and stuff like that. There's always good fights.
I mean, how about kicking the crap out of some bad guys?
There is. I can give you a few. Statute of limitations is all gone. I can give you a few and see. I'll let you choose from some. I had a recruit one night, and we were going through this dumpy motel parking lot, and the kid was sharp. I'll give him credit. He was sharp, and I saw it, and I was kind of waiting to see if he would see it. Going through a parking lot at this dumpy hotel at 3 in the morning, the car is running in the back of the lot, which is odd, and you don't need a reason to run a license plate. He goes by, doesn't pay any attention. I'm watching him, and he runs the license plate. I'm like, all right, cool. Well, sure as shit, the car is stolen. So I look at him and said, now what do you want to do? I said, well, let's go see what he does. Yeah, that's what I'd do. So let's go park a block away and see what he does. We always had binoculars and stuff like that. So we loop back around. Well, he saw us, and now he wants to run, and the chase is on. Well, the recruit's gone, and we had video cameras in the car at this point and microphones. And I'd like to think that I was pretty mellow and relaxed most of the time as a cop. When I needed to be worked up, I was worked up. But we're chasing this guy. And this is the area of town that I work, so I knew it like the back of my hand. We're going down, and he had a G-body, a Regal or an Olds or something like that. And he takes a ride on this one main street, and we're running pretty hot. We're 60, 75 miles an hour, and he takes this right, and he's sideways and everything, straightens out. And instead of staying on the road, he decides to take another right, and he just busts through a chain link fence, just like you see on TV. And what he didn't know is that chain link fence was the fence that kept people out of our quartzite quarry.
Old Dukes of Hazzard.
And you see on the videotape, we had 8mm cameras. You see on the videotape.
Taillights.
Yeah, no, you see taillights, and then you don't see taillights. And then you hear Officer Justin, the training officer Olson, in the passenger seat, stop, stop. It's a stop of his lungs because it is straight down. Shit. And so I grabbed the radio. I said, put the car in park. I grabbed the radio, and I'm probably screaming like a little girl on the microphone, on the radio. We get out and look down, and there was one perimeter road that went around that he could have caught, and he caught it, and he stayed there. So we get down there. We find it was 24/7 operations. We get somebody from over there, and they lead us down there and whatnot. And this old guy is 75, 80 years old. Been working in the dirt his entire life, and he comes over and he's smoking his cigarette, and he's like, ah, that guy's lucky to be alive. He'd already been handcuffed, and somebody else took him away, and we got to deal with the crash and all that mess now. And he's like, man, he'd have been 50 feet over that way, that'd have been a problem. As he's standing here chain smoking his unfiltered camels. So, yeah, what's over there? Well, that's the dynamite room. Whoa. Okay, then.
Damn.
It would have been, been great. But you had weird stuff like that. You had, I remember me and another officer actually debated. We were outside of a bar with some cowboy that was just drunk and just an asshole. And he's pushing up his sleeves and he's rolling them up and he's getting his pants ready and he's ready to go. And me and my buddy, Tom, he debated. Well, who's going to pepper spray him? You want to pepper spray him? Well, I don't want to do the paperwork. You pepper spray him. Well, I'm senior to you and I don't want to do the paperwork. And this guy's getting ready to fight. And he's been punching cows his entire life. He's 55. He's been around the block and psh, and he's down on the ground crying just like that. Lights out. And I'm like, oh shit, now it's 2 hours of paperwork. And that wasn't even any fun.
How much shit can you possibly fill out about that? Like,
well, it's
guys out of line. Yeah. Pepper sprayed him.
It's like, done.
It, the arrest report is easy. It's the use of force. And then it's the internal paperwork. And
I pepper spray fuck face.
Yeah, exactly. Justin. Yeah. Look at my videotape. You'll see why he got pepper sprayed. But it's, you got to go down to jail and you got to get him medically cleared because they might get traumatized. And it's a lot going on. But then there's things like you get called to somebody's house for a drunk person that's passed out and you walk in and it's a 6'5", 300-pound guy that's completely naked and he's drunk and passed out and you got to drag him out in the front yard and try and put him into a police car. You ever tried to put a 300-pound sweaty drunk guy that doesn't
more
do
times
anything?
Than you think.
Yeah. See? See? You can relate.
No, elaborate, Josh.
You know, and it's what you see on the news, you know, your local news, what you see on the news, I mean, they never talk about the cops that got spit on, the cops that got in a fight, the cops that got punched. They talk about the bad car accidents, the bank robberies, or whatever the case may be, or the fentanyl overdoses nowadays. And it's like, yeah, but I kicked somebody's ass last night. How come that's not on the news? Yeah. That was way cooler than that other story, you know. But
what type of personal discretion do you have as far as, like, traffic offense stuff, whether it be speeding or, you know, no license, no insurance, no proof? I mean, is it, do you have a heart in that point, or is it kind of like, hey, this is the rule?
I think
the car play a role in it.
I think this will answer your question. Oh, I stop cars just to see. You know what? I just thought of another story that this will all tie into. Our agency did not have a quota. And I know that's a popular thing out there, and there might be some that have them. We did not have. We had expectations. You're expected to do similar work to your counterparts and other people. If Officer Jones is out there writing 50 tickets a month, you should be writing some tickets a month.
But you don't like that type of guy, right?
No, we don't like that guy. You know, blanket parties, the bars of soap and shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you hold them down. Yeah. You had an expectation. I mean, there was always slugs that weren't answering calls, weren't doing anything. They go there for 8 hours and they go and hide or something like that. But we didn't have quotas. Under a tarp on a trailer. Or their lug nuts are missing and they're disabled on the side of the road. I worked on our DWI task force for several years too. I didn't have much tolerance there because that was expected of me. Did everybody go to jail for DWI that was drinking? No, absolutely not. You still had to pass it. You know, you had to try and pass the test or fail the test. Speeding, it wasn't really my thing. I had kind of an 11 over type of thing. Now, if it's 2 in the morning and you're in the hood and you're going 3 over, that's a different story.
Because you probably got something that is...
Because I want to know why you're in the hood. Mm-hmm. I want to know why you're going by the crack house that I know is a crack house.
You might not get a speeding ticket, but you're getting pulled over.
Yeah,
to,
yeah, exactly. But everybody has their limits, and it depends on the sections you're in. Like our traffic cops that do the daytime enforcement, they might have a 7 mile an hour over type of thing. Me at night, I didn't run a lot of radar. I didn't care about speed. If you're speeding, yeah, you're probably going to get talked to, but I could care less about the speeding. Now, if you've had a 12-pack in you, that's a different story. So it's an avenue. It's a segue.
It amazes me, again, I'm just from my fandom over the last 10 years of, and my we got family members that are, my uncle has been for 25 years. But anyway, the cars that are doing dumb, people are doing dumb shit.
That's just it.
The stupid stuff that they can't take care of tag light, brake light, blacked out tent. You know, you never pull over a champagne Toyota Camry with everything working and the guy following all the rules. And then you do this guy and he's got busted out taillights. This isn't working, you know, and the car's obvious and it's got, you know, two kilos.
Got
in
a pound of weed in there. Yeah.
That's kind of the reason they're doing stupid. It's you know, like it's a whole lifestyle.
A lot of it goes,
but if you're about to transport, if you're about to transport a large amount of drugs, do a quick walk around. Like you don't have to do a full, you know, like CDL check, but my tag light's working. I should be okay.
Yeah.
You hire Clint Eastwood.
The mule. There you go.
Yeah. Maybe I should pull this limo tint off my window when I've got, you know, 2,000 pounds of crack in the trunk.
And it's so much of it's common sense, too, because it's, I mean, I got a couple of Harleys. I got one that's loud and obnoxious, and I got one that's pretty mellow and pretty comfortable. When I'm riding the loud and obnoxious one, I take a look in my mirrors before I do something stupid.
Right.
And, you know, if I want to downshift and crank on it and make it loud. But it's all common sense. It's, I've seen some pretty awesome muscle cars in our area do a burnout when they shouldn't have been doing a burnout to get a ticket. No, hell no. But I want to look at their car and tell them, probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah,
but
fucking weak, yeah.
We have our annual, we have our Saturday car cruise get together and we have a cars and coffee on a regular every 2 weeks or whatever back home. And no, they'll get done with that and they'll bang it through the gears and light it up. Well, my dad's a retired cop. He did 27 years. He was a captain. And it just eats him alive. Eats him alive. He'll be there. My brother's still a cop, so he'll tell my brother, you should probably get some special attention down here for these guys doing burnouts and banging through the gears. I'm like, come on. It's a straightaway. Yeah, I know it's the middle of the day and there's other people around, but.
Right.
You just pre-give everybody a Mustang a ticket.
Yeah. Mustang stuff.
Yeah. I got rolled when I was 17 in my Camaro doing like, it's probably 30, 40 over on a side street. Just like, running it through the gears, you know, and just worst fucking time. I mean, terrible place to be doing it, right? But cop fucking right there. Guy pulls me over and he tells me to get out of the car. I had three buddies in the car. So I'm like, I'm going to fucking jail. This is it. My dad's going to kill
me. Pissed.
My dad's going to take the fucking car away. And the guy, he calls me up to the car and he tells me that, he's like, I get it. It's a badass car. I get it. You want to get on it. Everyone's just like, I got a Corvette. Can I get on it? Oh, yeah, I get on it. It's like, you got to do that out on the highway.
What?
It's out on the highway?
Yeah, that's what he told me. He's like, don't be doing that around these side streets.
The hell you say?
You take that out on the highway, you know, when you got to do that.
That's county's jurisdiction. Yeah.
Why don't you bring that piece of shit vet out there? And see what it's got.
Yeah, we'll fucking run him, bitch. Then I got a ticket.
This summer, we had our good friend and customer Joe Rogan on the show. In this clip, he talks about how he first got into martial arts, how discovering it changed his life and still shapes his career. He's a badass. I mean...
Who?
Joe. I think he goes by Joseph.
Rogan. Okay.
Joseph Rogan. Yeah.
Honor, man. Great time. Great fucking chatting with him.
It was a highlight of the year, yeah. I would assume.
Absolutely.
For me. It was my highlight. Are you gonna tell Joe right here in his face that it wasn't your highlight?
No, that was 100% my highlight.
He'd beat your fucking ass.
100% he would. 100%.
You seek out stuff that's hard and hurts. And most people don't want to do that shit.
Hard and hurts, but it's rewarding.
Well, yeah.
I seek out things that are difficult because I think that's how you learn about yourself. That's how you get. Yeah, that's how you become a better person. And I think that makes you better at everything. I think difficult things that are challenging and exciting, they make you better at everything you do. So, and I've always gravitated towards things that are scary, things that are hard to do. That's what I like to do. I like to do things that challenge me. So whether it was fighting at first or stand-up comedy after that, or, you know, doing podcasts or all this stuff. And now bow hunting, I like... And working out, of course. I just like challenging shit. It keeps me sane. You know, I've got a unusual mind, and my mind, like, I can't just sit idle. I lose my fucking marbles. I have to do shit. If I'm just sitting there, I start like pacing and staring at the walls. I need to do stuff, and I've figured that out. Luckily, early on in life, so I don't wind up in prison. I figured out that I have to do something. With challenging and exciting all the time. And if I don't do that, I don't feel right. But But if I do do that, I'm the nicest guy in the world. Like, I'm so happy and peaceful. And it's like, as long as I just squeeze all that caveman out of me.
Yeah, I'm with you.
You know, it's like I can be a better person.
How early on did you realize that?
Like, almost immediately. Like, my parents talk about it, like what I was like before I started fighting and then when I started fighting. Like, when I started doing martial arts, when I really got into it, I was like 14, 15. It was like, my mom talks about it. It's like, I was two different people. I was this wild, scary kid who was just reckless and angry. And then all of a sudden, super focused and super disciplined. And so I realized very early on, because like martial arts was the first thing that I ever did where I realized like, hey, maybe I'm not a loser. You know, because everything before, like I was insecure. You know, my parents split up when I was real young. And, you know, I have a great stepdad, awesome dude. And him and my mom been together for 50 years now. So it's like they have a great relationship. But we moved around a lot. So, like, I lived in we moved from New Jersey to San Francisco when I was 7. We lived there till I was 11. Then we moved to Florida. And I lived there from 11 to 13. And then Boston from 13 to 24. So it was like, I was always moving. And so I didn't have like a good group of friends, and I was kind of insecure, and, you know, and I was getting bullied, you know, when I go to these new schools. So that's like, I got to learn how to fight. And so that's when I started doing martial arts, and it just changed who I am. It's like, it gave me a thing where I realized, like, if you dedicate yourself to something, you can be someone. You could actually be happy with who you are instead of feeling like a failure. Instead of feeling like this insecure weirdo, like now I felt like I was someone important. You know, I was getting praise for what I did. I realized I was actually good at this. And then I won a bunch of tournaments, and I won the state championship 4 years in a row, and I won the U.S. Open and all these other tournaments. And I just really got into that. And then that just sort of defined the whole rest of my life, because I realized if you go all in on something, and you really push yourself and dedicate yourself, you see these incremental steps of growth. And that, an understanding that that process exists in everything you do. And it exists in whatever art you pursue, whatever you try to do in life. Well, I mean, everything from trying to be a better husband, be a better father, be a better friend, be a better neighbor. Like, everything you do, you get better at with time and focus. And that was just a lesson that I learned when I was a young kid, luckily. I mean, I always wonder, like, what would have happened to me if I didn't discover martial arts? You know, I would have been a completely different person. I've probably been very lost.
You got to have that one thing.
Yeah, that passion.
Yeah, not like to compare myself to you, but the only thing for me was cars. Like, I was the same thing. I mean, dude, I couldn't not even get any sports, anything like that. And I think about, well, if I didn't find cars and realize that I'm pretty good at doing things with my hands, I don't know what the fuck I'd be doing.
And drugs right and now. Fighting or what? I mean, something.
Probably, yeah, like, fighting, not very good at it, though. Like, you know, I'm not Joe's size. I'd
Most
be my
people
ass
that are in jail are in jail because they, you know, they grew up in a terrible environment. They had bad guidance, you know, and a bunch of bad experiences with people around. They fell in with the wrong crowd. They got the wrong ideas about what to do with life, and they never developed a real direction. And I think that, you know, that's tragic, and that could happen to any of us. You know, it's just, you find a thing that you love, whether it's building cars or art or music or whatever the fuck it is that speaks to you. You can find that thing and you realize, like, oh, this is like part of what I think. There's like human reward systems that are built into people from all of our genetics and all of evolution, and these human reward systems, they reward problem solving, and they reward like task-oriented goals where you're creating something and accomplishing something. And that's like what literally led us out of the caves and us to create cities and agriculture. It's all this figuring out how to do things better. And when people don't do those things, they get depressed, they feel lost and aimless. And that's a lot of people out there that are on medication because their life sucks. And it's like, I don't think that's the solution. I think, I mean, there's definitely people that have chemical imbalances, and this It's great that there's stuff that can treat people like that, but there's also people that just live a life that sucks.
Oh, yeah.
Their life just is not exciting. It's not interesting. They, you know, it's like there's a great quote by Thoreau that I always use, and it's that most men live lives of quiet desperation. Mm-hmm. And if you're stuck doing something that you don't want to do, that doesn't give you any joy, that you don't get excited about, you have no passion for, and you do that most of the day, and then by the time the day is done, you come home, you just want to have a cocktail and you watch TV and you get up in the morning, your body's falling apart, and you're just doing the same fucking thing until your heart stops beating. And that's a lot of us. That's a lot of us.
Your mind is never solving any problems. Your mind,
yes,
it's never working on a problem. If you're passionate about something, it's constantly solving a problem to get better at that thing you're so passionate about. If you're, like you said, you're going through the motions at a job that you fucking hate, your mind's not solving a problem of how to get, you're just fucking miserable.
And there's also, like, what you guys do is there's the joy of creation. You know, when you guys start out with just a raw car, an old beat up car, and you remove the panels and you change the frame and you change the suspension and you start working on everything. And then all of a sudden, bam, you got a car like that 69 Camaro that you guys made for me. I mean, I sent you that car. It was a friend of mine. He had that Camaro and, you know, he's like, I don't drive it. It's just sitting around. Do you want it? And I looked at it. I was like, roaster shop. let's go. And now it's a masterpiece, you know. And I know for you guys, the satisfaction of being able to create something like that and put it together, like, that's a joy. And life should be about those joys. It should be about, like, finding that thing that gives you pleasure, that gives you joy. And I think a lot of it is, you know, like, whatever speaks to you. And everybody's different, man. Some people, it's fucking playing the violin.
Yeah.
Some people, it's building muscle cars. It's like, it's just what speaks to you.
Yeah, it's
crazy.
Do
you feel like you ever get to the point where you've mastered something and can't take it any further? Or do you then go back and find weaknesses and punch holes in it and keep taking it further and further? Or do you shift gears and go to something else?
Well, luckily, the things that I like, you could never master. You know, the things I like, you never master. Like stand-up comedy. You always have to write new material. You're always writing new jokes. Every show is a new show. There's always new things you have to add. You put out a special, you got to start from scratch. In jiu-jitsu, there's always someone who can kick my ass. It's like there's no way to master it. You get better constantly. It's a constant process, but you never get better. Same thing with bow hunting. You get better, but you never master it. Like you just, it's a constant process of ever improvement and practice.
It's like
those are the things that I get excited about.
It's like any art, you can never master. Car building is the same way. If you think you mastered it,
there's no end. There's no finish.
If you think you mastered it, and you're comfortable where you're at, dude, somebody's going to kick your ass. You're going to get blown over.
Right, because you think you don't
just
have
look
to
at what
better.
You guys do. Look at what you guys do in comparison to the original cars. I mean, think about that. Like, think about like an original 1969 Camaro and how they drive and handle and the capabilities of them, and then what you guys build.
And we drove yours when it showed up. It was something.
Yeah.
It sucked. It was fucking horrible.
Yeah. They're still fun. They're still fun to drive, but man, the difference is.
It is, dude. When that one showed up too, I'm like, Josh, I'm like, dude, you gotta call Joe and tell him this thing's like it's a pile of shit. Like, I don't know how to I haven't met Joe yet. I'm not gonna call him and tell him that. You gotta tell them this thing's fucked.
We just didn't know what the expectation. Like you said, we were talking about doing a Survivor at that point and not doing the paint or whatever. And then it was kind of like, yeah, man, if we're gonna do it, like, let's do it. And you didn't hesitate. You're like, I want it right. Make it right. Back in June, Lance Stander, CEO of Superformance, came on to discuss iconic 1960s replicas like Chevy Corvettes, Ford GT40s, Shelby Cobras, and Daytona Coupes. And yet to be tasted Heaven's Door whiskey.
Coming soon.
It's coming soon.
What else is coming soon is me procuring one of Lance's vehicles.
Is it?
That's going to happen. It's going to happen, guys.
You're just saying all kinds of wild things.
I say things, you know?
Prove it.
Good stuff, man, Lance's.
It was awesome one.
Lance built some cool shit.
Yeah.
Awesome chatting with him. That one was really enlightening. That was cool.
Little known fact, he's from South Africa. If you don't believe me, listen
to the podcast.
If you don't want to listen to it, Google it.
Here's a clip.
As you started looking at it, you said marketing, rolling out more models. Was that an easy decision? It is simply the GT40 is a natural progression that's the next car we're doing. What was the thought process on what comes next, right? They had two models for years and years and years. So how do you follow that up?
So, you know, it went, as I said, it went from the Cobra and then the Daytona. And you know, we had a lot of time with Peter Brock. He initially discounted us and said, I'm not having anything to do with the kit car company or anything like that. And it took a lot for us to convince him. And he did eventually go to South Africa. And then when he saw what we were doing, you know, became part of the team, and he developed and designed the car for us, the future Daytona, the one we build now, the 93-inch wheelbase. And all along, he wanted a 93-inch wheelbase from Carroll back in the 60s. He didn't want to put the body onto a little FIA, well, a slab side at the time. But anyhow, you know, once that worked, and the GT40 was always a dream car for all of us. I mean, that you know, that's a car we had posted on the wall and stuff like that. But we knew it was going to be a really difficult car. And we'd seen other companies, you know, that went with a space frame kind of a thing, or a stainless steel type monocoque with a fiberglass roof and all that. And we'd known all along we want to do this car exactly how they did it back in the 60s, with the pressed steel panels, with the spot welded joints, you know, everything had to be correct. And it took us meeting with all the ex-old employees at FAV, Ford Advanced Vehicles in England, spent time with Holman and Moody, Lee Holman, and some of the drawings and blueprints and stuff that he had. The other guy's name's gone out of my head now, but it comes. He helped us with a lot of stuff with the GT40. And it's a very slow process. Jim Price, the owner of the factory, is an absolute perfectionist. He'll drive anybody crazy, and he's a reader. He reads book after book after book on anything to do with cars, and the guys who are behind him, the guys who developed him. I can't take any credit for that work that's done at the factory personally. It's just, you know, I'm a driver, and I want it to happen, but these guys are the guys who did all the hard work and figured everything out. And you know, he did travel to the UK, spent a lot of time meeting with owners of original cars, and we eventually did get an original Mark II, because we came out with the Mark II GT40 first, which is always known as the American GT40. That's the car you see in the movie that won the race in 1966, first, second, and third. It was a Mark I, but Carroll changed the body to get more air in, because he put the 427 big block in, so he had to get more air in. So he changed the rear clam. He also changed the angle of the nose. He put a slight. If you have a Mark II and a Mark I staying next to each other, you can't even notice it really. But you know, you guys would, and most people won't. But there's a steeper slant on the nose on a Mark II, and that gave it more downforce, because it was a. The car ran 226 miles an hour back in 66. Wow. I mean, it's mind-boggling that those guys passed. And then I've always known, you know, the next car, we hadn't done the Sebring cars. And they were only four. It was actually two Sebring cars, but Carroll raced it four different colors and with four different drivers. So it changed color and spec. And it was Dan Gurney. That's the Cobra that he won in. Ken Miles, Dave McDonald, Dan Gurney, Bob Bonnerant. So we then came out and we did a special run of only 15 Sebring cars. But at the end of the day, we built a couple extra, because once Dan Gurney was still alive at that stage, wonderful man. I had such wonderful conversations with him. And he said, Lance, I got to have one of these. So we arranged with Shelby. They traded an extra number, and we built a car for Dad. And then there was another special request from a very big car collector that he doesn't want known. So we built another one. That was a really special car that we did, the Sebring Cobra. You can have a look it up. It's interesting. And, it just carried on there. But my passion was to do the Grand Sport all along. I was totally a Chevy guy when I lived in South Africa. And so not a Ford guy, believe it or not. Became a Ford guy here in America.
You bought the right company to start.
Right. Yeah.
The Grand Sport was an interesting one when I saw that come out, because that was one I always said to myself, why has nobody recreated the mid-year Corvette? It's one of the most beautiful cars ever built in the history of the automobile. And when that came out, it, from the outside looking in again, I said, man, it's going to be a huge hit, right? It's, it, it was interesting to me that you chose the grand sport versus just more of a replica of the factory, just a big block 427 or a 63 well, split window coupe. Was there a reason yeah. for that or just fit the yeah. brand?
Easy to explain, really. It's all about money. At the time when we brought that car, when we were doing the mid-year Corvettes, you could still buy mid-year Corvettes for 30 to 60,000. You know, this I'm talking 15 years ago almost. Sure. Well, 13 years ago. So we could, and we anything we sold at the time, we'd have to sell what we call a roller minus engine and transmission, as mm-hmm. as we sell them now, would need to be between 40 and 60,000 to recoup the money it cost to build the cars. And so that was not going to be possible. We weren't going to sell anything. And the thing is, we wanted to bring out the car that that wasn't well known. I mean, to say it's famous, it wasn't well known at the time. There were only five originals. They really only raced for 1 year because GM pulled the plug on support. They raced after that, but they raced in privateers' hands, and that's when they got all flared and you know, because they had a racing group five, I think it was at the time, and the cars were way faster, so they had bigger tires and they flared the fenders. So the original Grand Sport that won against the Cobras in the first races until GM pulled the plug was, you're right, looked just like a 63 Corvette. But the Grand Sports, they were all converted, flared, and two of them had the roofs cut off and became the Roadsters. So we had to do that car and round tube frame car, which wasn't the same as a regular 63 Corvette or anything like that. So we had to do that car. And that, you know, the originals were, even at that point, they were worth 3-4 million. Now, of course, they're probably worth 10-15 million or more. So we knew we were copying a car that had a lot of value. You couldn't just go buy one.
And that, were the round tube frame, was that original to that design?
Yeah.
I've always wondered that. I mean, we manufacture, yeah. that's one of our more popular chassis that we manufacture is the mid-year Corvettes, and we, you know, duplicate some of the factory contours. But seeing that as a chassis builder, I was like, I wonder why they did. I'm very familiar with that car. I just never saw what was underneath it.
Yeah. No, originally he did that. And, you know, it's quite interesting what he did, August Donovan. And, you know, to win in racing, unfortunately, you have to cheat and not get caught. And if you can not get caught, you will win. And nobody even knows. But if you look at our Grand Sport, it's 7/8 scale. It's not the same size as a 63 Corvette. And he did that back in the 60s. He saved over 200 pounds by bringing the car out at 7/8 scale. Nobody managed to notice that.
I've never noticed that either.
Yeah, that's it. And I'll tell you, it's actually a funny story. We got the blueprints from Bob Ash, who owned all the stuff at the time. And I bought a whole two storage lockers full of parts that he'd made, because he restored three of the original Grand Sports, but worked on all five of them. And he had made copies of every bit of the parts, plaster Paris molds of the body and the interior and stuff. We bought all that from him. He had a complete Grand Sport body, the very thin one, because it was very thin. The Grand Sport, the race car, came in at 2,000 pounds. So you got an idea that the 63 Vet is about 32 or 3,300 pounds, somewhere around there. You can correct me. I don't even know. But I know it's over 3,000 pounds. And the race car was only 2,000. And that's all the stuff that August Dunlop did. Anyhow, we build the first Grand Sport, and the car ships and arrives here in America. And I get in the car, and my arm is bashing the door, and I'm not comfortable. And I'm like, what is going on? Call the factory up. You got screwed up. You did something wrong. This car's not right. We can't fit up. I've got owners. I'm not an exceptionally big guy. I'm only 210 pounds. I've got 250-pound owners that I want to get in this car. And I said, well, you got. So they went back, and they looked at the door panels, and we tried to see what we could do. And we made some changes to the door panel and stuff. But your arm bashes the door. And then we discovered we had copied that car too perfectly. We copied it at 7/8 scale.
You took a car that in its like factory configuration is already a little too small
and then
for most people to drive. Yeah. And then you shrunk it, right?
Yeah, we're bigger. Well, they never picked it up. You know, race car drivers those days weighed 165 pounds. And, you know, those guys were slim and slender. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I can imagine we did a lot of 32 Ford Roadster rollers years ago when the hot rod stuff was pretty popular. And it seemed like the smaller you make the car, the bigger the guy is that wants to buy it and sit in it.
Every time.
All right, so we'll bring out a 61 Cadillac. And like a guy my size is like, yeah, that looks good.
5'7", 150 pounds.
You bring the 6'2", 350. He's like, I want to fit in that Model A. Not gonna happen,
we
buddy.
We get him walking up to the GT 40. That's the guy. We see him coming along. You can see him a mile. He's coming. He's going to ask to sit in the GT 40. Oh, God. That's not going to happen. Yet we have, believe it or not, there's a little more room in that car than we're in. So we have done owners up to 6'4 in height, but you don't get a full GT 40 seat. You get a pad. You get a pad that shapes into the car, and it's not too uncomfortable. If you take the seat out, you'll see the body has that shape. So my one installer is a big guy. He weighs about 260 pounds, I think. He's only 5'11", but he's very fat. And he builds them and he test drives them afterwards, but he pulls the seat out. It pulls out very easily, and he sits in them with no seat and drives them around.
Sean Davis is the brains behind Autotopia LA and came on the show back in August in person to talk about his transition from music to the automotive world. We had what a jam-packed
weekend.
That
was a weekend there.
I don't know if... Yep. So, we started off. He flies in, right? Him and his crew. We do three cars. We do
one podcast. Well,
okay, bro, we do two. We do
burnouts. Awesome shit.
We do two cars.
Get yelled at by farmers.
We do two cars. Great. Go to a concert with Whitey Morgan.
Yep.
Fucking badass. Absolutely
had
awesome.
Had another podcast with Whitey.
Had another podcast with Whitey. Go to Whitey's show Friday night.
Whitey gives us a shout out.
Dedicates
a song to us.
Joe's cool. I'm backing it up a little bit. That was probably the coolest. Then it's so fucking awesome. We're hanging out, we're partying, all that stuff. Both of you guys are like, you know what, Josh, you've been doing such a great job. Why don't you go meet Sean tomorrow morning early? Because he needs to get that last photo shoot done.
That was your takeaway from it?
Is that what we said? I thought it was something like, I've got to go to Indiana in the morning to take my son to a skateboard competition.
They had a baseball tournament.
We've got to get this car shot. Can you please get here and help Sean out and drive the car? We just need a body with a pulse. Somebody that can
drive. Anybody can do it.
Sean's the talent. Sean will carry you through it. He will carry you through it. Just drive.
Here's a clip of that show before all that happened.
Tough, right? You're going from town to town to town. You're clearly not making any money, you know? And how do you keep, like, bringing the heat? These dudes are up there just bringing it every night. Yeah. You're like, if that was me, if I built, like, a car that nobody really liked and I had to go tour it all over and show it, like, every weekend
and nobody really
cared about it. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people that do that and really enjoy it. But for me, I'd be like, fuck, it sucks. Like, damn, come on.
It does. Let me tell you, dude, I've lived it. When you go from one night where you're playing like a festival and you're a total rock star, like people want to help you carry your equipment and your guitar and stuff. And then the next night you're in Rabbit Hash, Kentucky, you know, and a mayor is a goat that's eating the ferns off the stage in front of you. You know, there are those moments where, do you ever remember that movie, how am I drawing a blank on it? It's the most famous rock movie of all time, Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? So Spinal Tap was one of those movies. It was a rule. You do not watch that while you're on tour because you're living that life, you know? And it's just not funny at all to watch it. I mean, so, yeah, funny life. It was a fun one. But going back to what you said, yeah, dude, it set me up. So now standing in front of the camera, I feel like I'm talking to an audience. I mean, one of the greatest compliments I get is what you just said a few minutes ago, which is I'm just myself. Yep. It's not like, all right, put on douchebag for a second while the camera's going and then I'll just be myself, you know, and I've met some of those guys before and it's a little, you know, it's a little weird.
Especially like you talked about, I mean, between doing a completely different form of content with more pro touring cars or harder muscle car had an edge to them, stuff that enthusiasts and makers and builders were into versus, like you said, your more luxury cars and stuff that was And then that guy always has that same accent, you know, where it's like the whatever Mercedes goes from naught to 60. And it's,
yeah, I don't
it's
want to hear that.
You don't want to hear that. And it's cool. One, that's the cars that we're interested in. And, yeah, you know, the entire industry was. And you're talking, you're saying things like badass. And that, and you're just describing it, like you said, being normal.
100%.
Like that thing's fucking cool. Or
100%. I know right away, too, the car guys, I won't, like, as soon as somebody says it's got X amount of foot-pounds of torque, I know we're talking the same language. As soon as I hear a guy say it's got X amount of pound-feet of torque, I know we're not hanging out.
Yeah, dude, you can leave right
we're
now.
We're not hanging out. Right. We're just not. Like, I'm sure you're cool, but we're going to find shit we disagree on quickly. You know what
That's
I mean?
That's the aluminium versus aluminum. Alloy.
What was your buddy, the brake, or British horsepower?
Oh, yeah, British horsepower. So the BHP.
Everything was BHP in law, right. Road and track. She's like, oh, yeah. It's 350 British horsepower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's funny. Yeah.
That's another one. Brake horsepower. Is that really a, like, what the hell is that? Like, does the horsepower change when you take your foot off the brake? Or?
Is it when it breaks? Like, that's the max horsepower before it's.
We've had some brake horsepower.
Yeah. This is a good one.
You put it that way, it sounds kind of cool.
It does. Right? It was 1,000 like brake
force. Made 1,000 if we'd have gone to 1,001, fucker, it have broke. You know?
That first video, you've got the storage thing up. You said it was in the first year that you decided to do the video?
It was, yeah.
So you've got this thing rolling. You've just got a wild hair of like, we've got some cool ass shit. I know we can make some good content. Are you watching other stuff? You've got an idea of like the format, or you're just like, let's video a fucking car and do it?
Dude, we had no clue when we started. I mean, like, and people think like I'm being humble about it. No, we had no fucking clue. We truly had no clue. Like and the funny part was I live in LA, man. I have friends that are editors and actors and writers and so many different people. So one of my pals who's an editor said, well, you guys shoot and I'll edit for you. Cool. Liked this idea. So we started building up a bunch of content. He never got around to doing the editing part, so I ordered up Premiere Pro and decided to just start editing. And I mean, that I don't know if you've ever edited before, but not an easy task to do, especially when you don't even know what the hell you're shooting for. Like, where do we start? What happens in the middle? I mean, it was so bad, dude. But it was, I remember the car actually. You guys know Salvaggio and Speedcore and all those guys. So we had shot their car Tantrum. Remember that car? The one with the
QC4?
Yep.
QV, what did it call it?
Was it the GT?
It was the 9-liter one, that big.
The Mercury, the huge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I thought we were talking about the GT.
No, shut up. Okay. I fucking hate you guys. These guys fucking.
I didn't say anything.
Because Salvaggio once posted a picture of him in a Ford GT, right? So they have this thing, because I like GTs. So
he doesn't have one.
Yeah.
He doesn't have
everybody that has a GT, they have to let me know that I don't have. I know I don't have a fucking GT, okay? I'll probably never have
one. We've seen so many people that have them, though.
I know you have.
Salvaggio's got one.
We don't know that for sure. Wait, we're going to hit him up. I'm going to email him.
Sorry.
I might know a little bit about that one, but I'll stay out of it. I'll just stay out of it.
At any rate, the moral of the story is that
is that damn car was where we accidentally happened upon our format. Somehow I edited something different in that one. The video went fucking ballistic, and I went, let's do that again, you know? And that's where it kind of, by the way, my little brother owns a Ford GT.
Course he does.
See, now we're building points back up for the brother, right?
I would say who doesn't, but you know, he doesn't.
No, you don't. Yeah, that's the one guy that doesn't. But well, at this point, it's so common, I don't even know if I would want one anymore. It seems like it's like a camera.
Do they do a kit where you can turn your Fiero into a Ford GT? You can get the Testarossa, you can get the Diablo, you can get the Countach. Can you do the?
I hate you guys. But we had Lance, the owner of Superformance, on here recently. Maybe you've done one of his GT.
We shot a bunch of their cars.
They're fucking awesome, and I want one really bad. And talking to these guys, they've already ruined it for me because they let me know that if I get one, it's a replica. And I know
it's badass. It's badass.
But they're like, they won't give me the win. If I get that, I still will get
never.
Yeah, even though it's a sick car, they're gonna fuck with me. About it, because it's not a brand new.
You could have a badass Chewbacca mask, but if it ain't movie quality.
See, what if you had the 0506 Ford GT? Would that be
100%? Those are badass.
That's yeah. You can, come on, you're Roadster Shop, dude. You can go buy
honestly,
one of
those.
At this
point, I'd be fine with him having a Mustang GT. If he would just... Back in August, Eli Duckworth and Nick Morrow from Cabot Guns and Alchemy Custom Weaponry joined us. Cabot Guns and Alchemy Custom Weaponry is known for their precision-crafted, artistic 1911-style pistols. And if you're listening to this right now, fresh, they just dropped a new one called the Insurrection Double Stack. Go check it out. In this clip, they talk about some of their most creative projects that they've been a part of, and I think we probably just came across the line. Luckily, there was a lot of weapons here, and none of them were loaded. A lot of whiskey, a lot of drinking, a lot of shit talking, and a lot of guns.
A lot of kick-ass guns, yeah. Dude. That stuff was fucking rad.
Yeah.
They had that meteorite gun, wasn't it?
Yep.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah. Fucking cool shit.
I think I still want that Black Damascus one. That was
fucking badass.
Is that, does the discount structure still stand? Have we waited?
Depends
too long
how good the review here is.
Okay.
Yeah, we got
great guns. Probably some of the best 1911s you'll ever lay eyes on, hands on. You name it. Check those guys out.
And one of them's a pilot.
Good time, man. Eli Duckworth was a fucking blast. Dude's a riot.
Yeah.
He's got an Instagram page too. That's
1776.
Fucking
Duck.
Hilarious.
And Nick's got a Instagram as well. That I don't know what it is.
So good group of guys, man. Fun time.
So the best thing is when they come to us and they say, "Here's a budget. Do what you want to do," or even better, "There is no budget. I just have this idea," and then go from there.
Those are the best ones.
Those are the best ones. Those are the best ones, because then you can get super creative, and we have guys that just want to be surprised when they open.
Is that where that came from, over your shoulder?
I'm looking at it.
Yes, yes. So this was a custom commission, so this was engraved.
You can go ahead and grab it and bring it.
All right, I'm going to grab it. Everything's been cleared, but I'm just not going to clear this here because this is a customer gun. So this is a custom commission. And it is the Phoenix, and it is fully engraved by Jonathan Quill, a master engraver. And if you look at the top, all of this was inlaid and engraved with a special process to get the gold to be actually adhered and engraved onto the pistol, onto the image. And there's different colors in the gold from.
Can we show it on the?
Oh
on
yeah,
the
go
camera?
Ahead. Yeah, go ahead. And show it.
I've
up
never
there.
Seen anything quite.
Oh, yeah. Here, so whatever you do, don't rack it because it is a customer's gun. We want to make sure that he's the first person that gets to do that.
So no desk pop then.
No desk pops. I mean, hey,
I've got stuff if you want a desk pop.
If you want a desk pop, we'll do some desk pops. But this is a customer's gun that we're going to be delivering shortly. That is the Phoenix.
And if you look at the picture, so the picture is essentially like the life cycle of a Phoenix. And you can see the Phoenix rising out towards the muzzle. And, you know, that is a proprietary finish. You know, everything has an idea that goes into it. We don't do anything kind of randomly when it comes to this sort of thing. Everything has a purpose. And one big thing that we've kind of been known for, if you look there, you know, traditionally on 1911, you'll see.
I don't want to touch it.
Traditionally on the 1911, if you look here, you'll see like these cock insurrections. Well, we, you know, cock insurrations are awesome. Like you'll obviously, when we talk about alchemy, I'm very pro cock insurrections. Yes. But the cool thing about doing this cocking button is it actually takes allows the artist more surface area of the gun to play with. Now, this gun in particular did not really need that, but there are some guns where the entire gun is, including the grips, because we'll do like steel grips, and they will engrave the grips as well. Like for instance, Dante's Inferno, which is one of my favorites. But you know, we really want to give the artist the most basic canvas. And then we of course have to go back in and really tune, you know, bring everything together and bring it home. But, you know, that's one of the signature things for us is those cocking buttons, which just give you something to rack the slide with, but allows the art to still take shape.
Well, and one of the cool things is the customer gave us the idea and the engraver that he wanted us to use. And then the grips here, I'm looking at my phone because it's a Japanese word. It's Shusugi Bon. Which is
that's a burnt wood.
Yeah, burnt wood. Okay, I have to look it up every single time.
Y'all know Japanese.
Oh yeah. Y'all should do this now.
It's very popular in architectural and furniture making.
Well, it is. So what happened was the case maker, he wanted to have the case done in that style. So that is what the burnt wood on the bottom of this case is done. Well, we went and took the grips and were able to emulate that. These aren't actual wood grips. We were able to emulate that finish on the grips so that the grips match the case. And that's the whole thing, is being able to take these elements and not have them be random, have them be tied together through the whole project.
What is the rest of the finish on the...
It's a proprietary finish, so it's a proprietary
patina. It's badass.
It's badass. Yeah, it's badass. Yeah, you get like a little bit of that color case hardened, but not all the color.
It's stainless steel. So the gun is stainless steel and then obviously gold. So it is a proprietary stainless steel patina. It's a quick aging process that we do. And there's a lot of colors that can be done. So the engraver happened to do it on this one, but there's a lot of different things that you can do to really bring out colors and tie the whole thing together.
Norris Marshall is the CEO of Blueprint Engines. Founded in 1982, Blueprint is the leading OEM-level manufacturer of new crate engines. He's also a former drag racer, dirt oval racer, and today serves on the SEMA Board of Directors. He came on the show back in October to talk about the state of internal combustion engine tech and EVs. Let me tell you, that little short on YouTube made the fucking rounds.
Did it really?
Yeah, it got out there. Got some legs, as they say.
I like Norris, man.
Straight fucking good dude.
Fucking shooter. Yeah. Old school kind of guy. Tells it like it is. It's my kind of guy. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Going to be doing some big things in the internal combustion engine world. So keep the industry going.
Thought he was going to come in here dropping Werther's Originals. He came in here dropping fucking knowledge. So.
Damn.
Whoa. Yeah.
Whoa.
That's a fucking good one.
Yeah.
Hey.
Good thing this is recorded.
Yeah. Fucking. I like that. I like that little analogy.
I was telling my sales guy, Kel, today, I read on the internet, which is a great source for all information, but I don't think this is this is not new news, but I don't think everybody knows it. But there's like 17 states that said if California eliminates ICE engines, we're going to eliminate ICE engines. 17 states pledged to follow California. So I know that's one of the things that SEMA's doing, not because we think EVs are bad, but because don't think the state should be the one deciding, right? But Dodge, or Stellantis as it's known today, has come out and said that they won't put anything on the dealer lots in those states that's not a plug-in hybrid. You cannot buy a pure ICE vehicle starting in January from Stellantis in those 17 states.
That's bending.
I don't know why they're doing that, but I mean, it's like, really? My choices are already limited, and they haven't even enacted laws yet just because they said they were going to? That's crazy. It was
like smuggling cars into new states.
I mean, they're doing away
with it. I think it said you can order them, right? So this is Stellantis doing this. It's not the state doing it. So you can order an ICE vehicle, but...
There's just nothing in stock that you can walk in and
they're not gonna, dealer they're and not going to put them in stock. And I think we'll see a lot of those 17 states go away and say, now that we're serious about it, we don't want to do that.
Hmm. Yeah, they're wild times. You know, I wonder, all this talk about the electric stuff, you know, what's behind the scenes on it? You know, where's the funding coming from when you see all these companies moving towards it, that knowingly that it's not any better from an emissions standpoint? And like you said, I mean, 80,000-90,000 miles beyond that before it actually
helps. And it doesn't help very much.
And nowadays, what makes it to that? I mean, the days of, aside from the couple of dually trucks that we've ran for too long that are, you know, coming apart, that got 120,000-150,000 on them, most people don't maintain or keep vehicles for that length of time anymore. It's just not like that anymore.
Think about how much stupider people are going to be, though, if they only were driving EV cars for the next 20 years. They don't ever have to do anything. No thinking for themselves whatsoever. I'm not saying if it was the only option, people will take for granted the things you have to do in a normal car. The way we grew up, the things you have to do with driving a vehicle, putting gas in it.
Yeah, we have to
put gas in our vehicles, right?
I eventually when it runs out.
When it gets on E, you have to find a gas station and put gas in your vehicles. So you run into the nicest people.
Dude, I don't know. Stations. I mean, you want to talk, like, you could say that. That's a great argument, right? But I grew up and with my mom and dad driving a late 80s Corvette. Dad probably had a couple cocktails. Both of them are smoking cigarettes. I'm sitting in the back, you know, under that little convertible top area, that little well back there.
It's not a seat.
Maybe not. Maybe they're not getting stupider. You know, today it's like you like to think we're talking about like nostalgia. Yeah, it was cool. Like, man, back in the day.
This comes from a guy with an electric leaf blower, though. I can't listen to anything. Do they make electric backpack leaf blowers?
I don't know. I've just got the little one. I live in the woods, man. I don't want to have to tell my.
For your
I don't
want
to. Yeah, it, and that's what she uses. I don't want to have to field the phone call to tell her how to like pre-mix the gas or change the spark plug. It's yeah, plug the fucking battery in, blow the shit off the deck.
A couple pumps on the like bubble, one pull when it hits, turn that choke off.
Yeah, I walked through your manufacturing plant and I saw a lot of what you do to make it hard to do it wrong. You mistake proof or poke yoke, and you've got processes and the way you put the little tabs in and all that. So that it's harder to do it wrong.
Yep.
I bought an electric chargeable weed whacker because of that. Because I'm not the one running it, right? And especially at work, I might have anybody that's get that weed whacker and go clean that up. And it's like, yeah, the two-stroke deal is you got to be half mechanic.
That's a fouled plug for a newbie every time.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, I don't want that call saying, it won't start. Okay, well, I'm working and the business, I'm in a meeting, I can't go start the damn weed whacker.
Yeah.
So I did there, it. I thought it was all right.
There's a time and a place for it. I mean, out of convenience, it has its place. If we're talking emissions, like, let's be truthful about it, you know? If we want to sell it just like sheerly out of convenience that, hey, guess what? You don't have to change the oil. There's minimal maintenance. Yeah, it's going to, you know, there's people digging holes in, you know, Africa and child labor, and it's, you know, polluting the hell out of the environment. But hell, you know, you don't have to take the damn car and change the oil. It's great. Let's just be honest about it, you know.
I think that's 50-50 all
50 there. Never change the oil.
I'm driving it.
I really think that's all it takes is for everybody to actually have the whole story and all the information. I trust people typically to make good decisions if they know everything about it. And I've pushed, and I haven't had to push very hard because it's been very well received, but pushed SEMA to say, hey, we need to tell this story at this show. And there's a group of us that have got on board and helped find the right speakers and get that forum set up and get the right presenters and get the right folks on display to tell that story so people understand.
Right.
Here's what's really going on. Here's our choices.
Yeah.
You also gotta trust you to make a decision.
You got to make sure that the people continue to want that story, because the story is a little longer sometimes. To know the whole story, in essence, the definition of it, it's a longer story than what you've been told before. Nobody wants anything that's a longer story. Everybody wants something that's quick, short.
Bullet points.
Want the 10 seconds on TikTok. Just, I deal with it, people all the time. You know what? Just tell me what I should get. Just tell me what I should get.
Blueprint
just tell me what car I should get. A blueprint.
Nice roadster shop chassis.
Nice.
I listened to the testimony of the public when the EPA was taking in public testimony on their new regulations. And the short and sweet ones were the people, and a lot of them were family people, moms and dads, saying, I have kids and I'm for clean air, so I'm in favor. That was it.
Yeah.
It was like, I don't think you really understand what you just said.
They There's don't want to more be to this. Than they don't want to be bothered with it.
Yeah,
they've got.
But I mean, it's compelling. What's that make me? The anti-clean air guy?
Right.
Right.
But I'm for Earth.
Yeah, I think
I'm pro Earth.
Yeah, I think there's more to the story. So.
Yeah, put the facts out there. Right.
What would you like? You're gonna. So you've been in on the board what a year? Year.
Yeah,
and a half?
A year.
You got to do 2 year term.
I think.
And then run again. Something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
What would you like to be known for? When you're done, your 17 terms or whatever you're going to run.
So if it works out right, there'll be a handful of people that know that I made a significant impact and a whole bunch of people that don't, because I'm not doing it for that. I really just want to help. I mean, I like praise and, you know, people.
Who doesn't?
But that's... those are at odds to seek those things. Right. I'm trying to help. I'm a little more of a smoke-filled backroom kind of guy. And I told them when I ran and when you get interviewed, you know, they got to select you to see if you're even qualified to run. It's like, yeah, I probably won't be the one at all the awards banquets that stands up on a stage and gets all the adulation. But
don't do that. I'll be, SEMA, do they?
You know, they might have a little bit. But I mean, anyway, I don't mind that. But that's not why I'm there.
Right.
Right. I will know if I made a difference, and I hope a few other people know, and then that's good enough.
This fall, Creative Rod and Customs Mark Giambavo. Still don't like
it. Sounds like a spaghetti dish.
Yeah.
It is. Fucking sure does. But.
Mark Massaccioli from Creative Rod and Custom came in.
I will have the Giambavolo extra parm.
Ooh, Giambavo with vodka sauce.
Mm, that sounds good.
Yeah, it does.
I think I'll have that.
Yeah. He came into the studio in person, like all of our good friends do. If you haven't come into person, it's a different experience. Come in the studio.
Hang out.
Sit right here. Or there.
Right next to Uncle Josh. We're both.
It's a great time.
As my kids would say, I think it just hits a little different in the studio.
It does.
Sounds weird you saying it.
Mark's an awesome
I felt like
dude.
It came out pretty natural.
Talented guy, man. Builder of probably one of the most bitchin' Model A's of all time.
Yeah.
Everything he does is rad.
In this clip, he tells the story about the guys and their creative process, problem solving, and how skateboard decks have inspired some of his builds. I'm still processing the fact of how our minds work, that we're completely derailed when just the slightest change in whatever our mind's eye vision is. And the problem, I guess it's from the creatives or the driven mentality or something like that, the difficulty we have in pivoting around that direction, you know?
And I was saying once you have that vision in your head.
Once you have that vision in your head, it's kind of like that's the vision, you know? And it's very difficult. Right. And I mean, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I mean, sure. Sometimes that the outcome, it always works. It's just funny how I think at anybody that's in doing what we're doing or any creative space or anybody that's driven to, they can see things, right? They can see it in their head, right? And some people can articulate that to others, you know, very well. Some people have to have rendering. Some people have to do whatever it is. But when that is altered, it changes your fuel. I mean, it's not even car related stuff. Like, I mean, with my wife or making plans, whatever, we're going to do a concert, you know, and we're going to do Chinese, right? So that's kind of like I've painted the picture.
Where's this going? On. Is this getting weird? Well, then, get weird?
No, it's not going to get weird. But then, like, oh, hey, that restaurant closes. We're not going to be able to make it in time. We're going to go do something.
You should see the temper tantrum that comes next.
Well, in my head, because if we've been talking about it for like 3 months, in my head, I'm kind of like, well, we've already made the plan. And I was like, well, fuck, I don't even want to go now. If we're not going to go do this and go, you know what I'm saying? And it's funny. You always adapt and you do. Sure. But I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I paint those things in my head of exactly, you know, down. Yeah. It's going to look like this. It's going to sit like this. It's going to have these wheels. It's going to look like this. And it's going
to
do this.
I think in a sense, it's like having that vision and pushing to execute it. You know, like Jerry's Model A is a great example. Like that car could have gone two directions. That car could have been a rat rod.
Yeah.
Like it could have been just a hammered Model A and everybody would have
painted almost feel like that's
painted satin black.
Maybe what she wanted originally. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. But it went to being like,
we all lost money.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it went from that to being that, to, like, you know, no bullshit, just because you're here, that's probably top five, one of my favorite cars ever built. Like I fucking love that car. And I'm assuming you had some sort of vision of the way you wanted that car to go.
Yeah,
and you executed.
No, I definitely did. And I think, you know, some of the stuff like, and I think that's where trying to maybe steer her in certain directions. And you guys probably maybe had to do that a little bit too, like with maybe the original stance and stuff she wanted out of the car. Cause I think, I almost feel like that, you know, dragging ass on the ground rat rod thing was her original like kind of vision, you know? And so then it's a matter of, yeah, and I think also too, like with her, like history, you know, with like the show circuit and the things she does with like the Pittsburgh World of Wheels and just the indoor shows and that. I just knew the car needed to go to a certain level. I felt like for what, you know, for her to be happy with it too, you know. But yeah, there were a lot of things like looking at the initial like thought process of her of like, okay, well, how can we refine this a lot, you know, and then. Looking at the, you know, the work you guys did with the chassis and the floors and some of that stuff was just such an awesome starting point that like just pushed that, you know, car pretty far forward. And but I look at a lot of the stuff. I have a 32 two-door that I've been building quite a few years for myself and getting nowhere with. But a lot of ideas, you know, like some of the roof stuff, I started looking at, you know, that car and some of the ideas I had for that. And that's where some of that came from. And you know, now I'm looking at my own car and I'm like, I might as well just build a rat ride for myself. Like I have nothing to go through all this craziness.
This costs way too much.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and a lot of that, there's so much in this, you know, business that's just problem solving type stuff. So like if I, you know, with that wood structure and that roof, like I had an idea, but I didn't know how I was getting there, you know? And then it was a matter of, okay, well, how can we accomplish what's in my head here, you know? So that was a big thing on trying to figure out how to do all that stuff and either do it efficiently or do it with the equipment we had available to us, you know? So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, the roof structure was cool. 'Cause I was actually looking at that and I was like, oh, that's clever the way you ran the wires for the dome light, because it was probably one of those things you talk about problem solving. You probably looked at that and you're like, man, how could I bore straight through this long ass piece of wood?
And the way it's done, it's actually, it's all layered together like a skateboard. So we could have routed a groove and put it in, but okay. I started looking at, like, you know, a factory roof structure. You tear a Model A apart or 32, like it's got that cloth wire just running through there, you know? And that's, I kind of wanted to see that. I just thought it'd be kind of neat to see it. But and that was, we looked at, you know, steaming the wood and building like a steam box. We looked at various different ways to do it. And then I guess I was just looking at a skateboard deck one day and I was like, you know what, why don't we just layer it and glue it together? It's going to take its shape. So we just built a metal structure there. And I think there's like 90 pieces of black walnut. And I had a local Amish cabinet maker. They took a black walnut beam and they ripped it down. It was eighth inch thick by 6 inch by 8 foot long pieces. And then, I didn't have a way to scan it or anything. So my brother, he built a grid on the roof there and just measured every point on it and then put all that into a computer and basically built, a file of what that structure should be and then broke it down into layers. So then that got sent to the water jet guy, and I didn't know you could water jet wood, but they laid all that wood out there on the water jet and they water jetted all the pieces out. And then we took them back and layered them and glued them, and sure enough they dried and then in the right shape,
and then old Jebediah laid it up and sanded it all down and finished it.
So it was a lot of we used a router to clean all the edges up, get all the glue, you know, off of it and that. And I think there's about 9 coats of clear on there to fill in all the wood grain and that and stuff. So and that's the stuff too where, like, you start thinking about that one idea. Yeah, and then you pitch it to a customer and they like it, and then you're like, oh shit, now I gotta like figure out how to do this. And then you start adding like the hours up of what, like, you know, in your head you never thought you'd have, you know, 250 hours building this wood structure or whatever it is, and then what the cost is gonna be. And I'm sure the customer doesn't at that point either. And then, you know, they reflect back on, oh man, was that a good decision? Was it worth the amount of money, you know? So, but
the finished product is though.
What's the wheelbase on that car?
It was 106.
I think, as I say, 106 or 107. I know it was stretched a little bit, so.
We tried to keep it pretty close to 32, so that those things start looking like.
Well, and that was hard, too, like being a sedan and it being chopped, like the car starts to get long looking, you know? And that's, so I ended up running that, I guess it's a 25-louver hood in it. It's got a couple extra louvers and a regular 32 hood. And when I talked to Rootlieb about doing that, they just sent me, they just punched them in a blank panel. And he's like, it's not going to fit a Model A. And I was like, no, it's, trust me, it's like the right amount. And it just, it enabled to just fill that out a little bit and not make it look so long. So
remember all those arguments you used to have with Rootlieb doing all the 32 stuff? It was constantly just send them, don't break them, don't run the beam.
Oh, yeah.
We just want the louvers. And they're not going to work. And you're going to have to do this.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. And we ended up ordering 2 sets because we fucked one up somehow. I don't remember what we did. We cut something wrong. So it's like, all right.
You know, I just think that car is so fucking well executed. Like, it's understated. There's so many areas where you could have gone, like, over the top. I fucking dig that thing. I actually have a confession that it was sitting in our booth at the Triple Crown, and I'm, like, looking around, and the door's open on it. And I'm looking around. I'm like, kind of sneak over there, sit in it.
Like, I had to take a picture of
and I've never done that. Like, that's obviously a no-no, right? You don't go fucking getting in people's cars, but I'm like, this thing is so cool.
Segue. There's something else we did at the Triple Crown late that night that
we did.
Not a lot of people know about.
Yeah, we did. I got a little nervous about that. I thought we upset Bobby, but.
Yeah, he was fine.
Okay.
You didn't seem too nervous.
Well, it was exciting.
It seemed like it was really.
It's kind of one of those things you just ask for forgiveness afterwards.
His, him and Toby's face as we were coming back through there.
Yeah. Well, we were all standing around hanging out. Whose idea? Somebody who came up with that idea?
Jesse's buddy Mike.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Mike or Finney.
And it didn't take, that took absolute, like, zero persuasion.
No,
that, to get everybody.
That was.
I was like, oh, we're going on the track? Oh, fuck yeah.
Well, I think he offered him a beer, you know, a beer to let us hang out a little bit longer, right? Maybe, and the guy didn't want to drink. And then, 2 seconds later, it's.
You think we can go out on the track? Yeah.
Yeah. You can bring four cars. Like, oh, we got eight.
Well, you know, it's
fun. You've been drinking. He said, I haven't even drank it yet. I just opened it.
I started counting. I was like, all right, I'm going to like, I got to get the fuck out here in front. Cause if he cuts it off, yeah, I don't want to be the guy that's left out. So
that was so fucking cool.
Anyway, for people that weren't there. Yeah. We talked the track official into letting eight cars go around the track at National Super Speedway.
Yeah. Was it 7, 8 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
Yeah. About it was awesome. That. So, yeah. You know, that was fun.
And then y'all just kept like going. Like,
we kept going.
It felt like we were going so much faster than we, like, I'm looking back at like videos. I'm like, man, I don't think we were going that fast. Like, it seemed like we were going, like,
Troy was going faster.
Yeah. Troy was going. So obviously you do the standard, Troy, like you've done enough, like good guy shows that, you know, when you do get to go out on track, you fall back, right? Cause you got the lead car.
So you fall back
so you can get like at least one hot lap. And well, me and Troy are thinking the same thing. I'm in Brent's 70 Chevelle. Troy's in the, 66, 67 Chevelle. So we get up next to each other, and Troy just absolutely fucking dusts me. I mean, blows the fucking doors off of that 70. That thing's fast. But yeah, that was fun.
We got, like, I guess once we got out on there, I was following Jesse, and I got on the Model A, and I just felt the ass end kick sideways on me. I was like, oh, this is going to be, like, interesting, you know? But it did all right out there. But then I think towards the end, I think, Jeremy, you ended up flying. You kind of got in front of me and in between me and Jesse. And then I could just hear the debris coming up.
Hey, you got to drive them, you know? Sorry, Jerry.